Hi, and welcome to the Inside Out Security Show. I'm your host, Cindy Ng, and joined by security practitioners Mike Buckby, Killian Englert, and Matt Radilak. I just came back from Microsoft Ignite, and I think it's a good reminder when we see the latest and greatest new dashboards and security technology, it's easy to be overwhelmed with the new. And that's when I like to go back to the basics to remind ourselves what's important. And when I was preparing for the show, I came across Christina Murillo's tweet. She's an InfoSec pro we interviewed for our podcast a year and a half ago, that the quote is, "If we don't have the discipline to stick with the basics, the cool tech doesn't matter. The basics matter. Don't ignore the basics." And this is by Rob Joyce. And she proceeded to list out the basics: patch management, least privilege, and logging. What else would you add to her list and maybe explain why they're vital?
Hey, yeah, this is Matt Radilak. Documentation. I think that a lot of organizations have some things in place, but fail to document it. And when people change or roles change, or when they actually need to dive into something, there's no documentation and no one knows what to do. You know, people panic. There's no incident response plan, or there's no incident containment plan, or even just like basic disaster recovery plans and how they're going to handle, you know, outages, or even a basic thing like a phone tree.
Hi, this is Mike Buckby. Before I give my answer, I just want to go off of Matt was saying an incident response plan. We actually have a new course that's free on how to build your own incident response plan. So maybe we can put a link to that in the show notes. And I was going to just push back on this just a little bit and say that I think what was listed are all the basics, but that with the current infrastructure being so diverse, where, you know, we have any modern large corporation has, you know, thousands of people in, you know, hundreds of locations with all sorts of different levels of technology and different stacks and different systems and applications, and it's just exploding, that even trying to get the basics right can be just incredibly complex. Again, not to be too self-serving, but I feel like that's one of the things Varonis really helps with, is, you know, trying to get that in terms of like user permissions, to really get those dialed back, because it's such a hairy, twisted mess in a lot of cases, through nobody's fault, just through the sort of accumulation over time of different systems.
Hi, this is Killian. To kind of start with Mike, I would tend to agree, but I would kind of take that a bit further, is because it's so diverse, there needs to be, maybe to what Matt said, is a process to check that it's working. You know, you can say we have a patch management or something in place, or if we have a documented process for that. But it's really, really hard to measure those metrics. And I think that's where a lot of people get a little bit in trouble. Like, hey, we have a patch management process, but how are we sure that it's getting, you know, we're patching all of our systems, I think is part of the problem. And to Matt's comment about simply documenting things, unrelated prior to recording this, just had a very long conversation with several people about a way to address differing opinions about how to deal with certain situations. It's nothing salacious or anything, just an internal procedural thing on how we respond to certain inquiries. And some people want to see a much more defined and documented process versus what we've implemented or documented in a different way. Coming to consensus, I think, on that documented process, you know, we have a process and we have documents we follow, but that might not be widely known to everybody, can be a bit of a concerning issue for some folks, because it seems like there is no process, but there is.
I think the one thing that's just outright missing here, I mean, they have least privilege admin, which kind of makes sense as like maybe reducing the number of domain admins that you have, or reducing the privileges of any of your admin accounts. What I see missing, number one, should be like user not using the same local admin password. Far too many people, before they can even get to the point of any of these things, fail at that. And that's one thing that attackers are going to try, you know, from step one.
So to boil that down, good password hygiene then, I guess, would be another basic that we're missing.
Good. So when I was at Ignite, I was talking to an attendee about the importance of monitoring your AD, where there might be instances where the guest account keeps getting locked out, and there could be many reasons why. But one thing to keep in mind too is that hackers might use the guest account as an opportunity to use it as a command and control center, because we've seen it in some instances. And if you're talking to a reasonable IT pro, they might get it. But how do you explain this to a C-suite individual? Maybe you don't bother explaining it at all and pitch something more high level, and then maybe you can provide monitoring AD as an example. But I want to know how to explain cybersecurity's new normal to the C-suite.
Something that one of my mentors here at work had told me at one point is about how to address that. And I think it was specifically about Active Directory. He said, they posed a question, I think very similar to this. And I said, oh, we got to talk about Active Directory. And he goes, if you bring up Active Directory to C-suite, you've lost the deal. And I'm using air quotes. You know what I mean? They don't care about the minutiae. It has to be about connecting it to really business value or higher level goals. And that's always something that I feel like probably a lot of us, and Matt, you might have some examples on this, is being able to effectively translate that to understanding the technology and the risk is important. But being able to package it up, I think, becomes much more critical when dealing with the C-suite. What do they care about? Reputation. They care about the top and bottom line. So tying it back to those concepts becomes very important more than anything else. And I don't think I've said anything revelatory here, but it's, again, one of those basics that I think becomes challenging, especially as we get more ingrained in security process.
My approach to this is to ask some leading questions, right? Like, one of the questions I'd love to ask the C-level executives is, first one is, what would you do, or what do you think the financial impact would be if no one could send emails for 3 days, right? Like, if your email service got knocked off for whatever reason for 3 days, you know, what do you think the impact on your bottom line would be? How would that personally impact you? How would that impact your sales force or, you know, your business development teams? And then the second one is around the same question is, and this is where I actually disagree some with if you don't bring up Active Directory with those people. I just try to bring it up in a very, you know, simple way, which is, do you think we can change all of our passwords? Have you asked your CIO if he could actually change every single password that there is inside of this network? Because if he says no, you are of a bigger risk there than you do, you know, and it's really about translating risk and then translating that risk back to dollar signs, right? And the way you translate back to dollar signs is because for XYZ application, which this person will probably have some high level knowledge of some of the major applications that they run, like in a law firm, it would be iManage, or in a finance firm, it might be the online banking app. And I would say is, if you've never changed that password, chances are it's going to cause system downtime and outage. And what is that outage's impact, right? Can you measure the outage of that mobile app at $1 million an hour, $3 million an hour? I think Amazon's something in the tens or hundreds of million dollars an hour of impact, direct financial impact, if Amazon.com is unavailable.
How did you know that?
Because there was an outage caused by a web developer, I believe last year, where he like fat fingered a key. And that was like a very, they used it as a way to talk about how, like, even with the greatest security controls, accidents are still happening. And they just mentioned what the direct impact was, like how much revenue, I believe Amazon actually publishes these statistics, how much they process in an hour or in a minute in terms of shopping cart processing.
You're in a meeting, how do they respond to your first question?
It's usually with that it would be bad, right? And it's usually with that there's a level of understanding that it would be very, it would be impactful. And then usually the next question is, you know, are you doing anything about it? And then the answer is typically no. People aren't thinking about these things. And then that's where you want to bring it back up to a high level, as Killian said, and really start talking about risk. Like, cybersecurity is a risk thing. And if you tie risk to dollar signs in one way or another, that's what you're going to get executive attention. Because dollar signs could be related to reputational damage, which a lot of executives care about, sometimes more than actual direct financial impact, you know, because people want to have trust in the companies they're doing business with. And I think the risk to reputational damage is high. Other times it can just be direct dollar signs, application outages, inability of your sales force to close deals. I mean, today is the end of quarter. If our sales force wasn't able to process POs for some reason today, it would have a direct impact on our bottom line. Those are things that any executive could understand.
This article that Cindy brought up from the Forbes Tech Council was really interesting in that it cast all this similar to how you're describing, Matt, in terms of time. It's not so much abstract that, oh, this thing is compromised or this is that, but it's that both, you know, the consequence and the prevention of these things can be measured in time. And you want the prevention time to be more than the exposure time, and that, you know, you can be reasonably assured you're secured in that case. You know, that to me, that's a nice way of considering it that just, again, makes it more down to earth.
And I think, you know, to expand on what Mike said, it's about understanding, you know, just I think that CIOs and CEOs and COOs, CFOs even, they actually have become more savvy and aware due to security awareness. They realize that they're getting phished and that they're the targets of phishing attacks. They're reading all of these articles that come up every single week on all these different news sites that say what a C blank O should know about NotPetya or cybersecurity or data breaches or GDPR. And that's because anytime that there's something that's changing in the business world, executives are where they are because they keep up with those things at the level of detail that they need to understand. And so I think even from a Verona standpoint, we get engaged by teams who said that their executive said they should look at a technology to do X. And it was the executive that brought up least access or global group remediation or threat detection and Active Directory that led to that IT or security engineer to reach out to Verona's.
In your experience or in your time having conversations with executives and C-levels, do you feel like there's a certain level of damage or does it occur enough that it could be impactful where nobody wants to give the executive bad news? They have a tendency to yes them, I guess. When you ask that question, like about about changing all the passwords, and they might ask their subordinates or something like that. Like, is this something feasible we could do? Do you think there's an inherent reservation about giving them an honest answer?
I think that's human nature, Killian. You know, I'll give you an example. I won't name the name of the customer here, but we were in an engagement about a week and a half ago where we were doing business with a large company who had many subordinate companies that were independent but owned by that parent company. And so from a Varonis standpoint, that meant that, you know, they would be purchasing Varonis like from different places, from different companies, instead of just once at the parent company level, which is a way that some companies do it. And we found a filer, like a file share of a subordinate company that was open to everyone at the global company level. And so we wanted to get in front of this subordinate company and explain to them that, hey, we found your data on this person's network. It's one of your file shares. And that person didn't take it well. They said, there's no way, it's not possible. And I think it was because there was a senior person in the room. It was because there was an executive in the room, and they were really embarrassed that that data was there and that they didn't know about it. But I think in the security world, I think we have that responsibility to do the right thing, right? We have that responsibility to that sort of higher authority. At least those of us like with CISSPs absolutely have that responsibility in order to protect personal data and preserve human life.
So in that scenario, what obviously our goal is not to put people on the spot and kind of throw them under the bus. What is your approach to deal with that situation to lessen, I guess, the personal impact of that individual? Or if you have any recommendations, because that's the thing that's really important.
Let people know that this stuff happens every day, right? I'm not the first person in Varonis to encounter this. I mean, we publish our data risk report, which is, you know, a conjunction of lots of risk assessments that we do. And it's to just get that. It's to get that free risk assessment, to sit down, see where they're at, understand about that data, show them the error, help them identify maybe how it became that way. It might have been a change at the firewall level and have nothing to do with the storage engineer or the Active Directory engineer. Someone might have left a particular VLAN on a particular switch port open that then someone connected to and connected that filer to another. I mean, there's so many different ways to kind of get back to what Mike said about, you know, how hard it is to secure everything now because of IoT devices, because of people plugging in their cars and mobile phones and all this new code that's getting pushed out all the time that isn't necessarily developed securely. It's actually getting really hard to even do the basics.
I was just going to say that there's, you know, a movement within a lot of the DevOps and security community for something called blameless postmortems that, you know, really try to take this head on, which is that, you know, just sort of at a base level, acknowledging that it is so complex and that even the best of situations can get out of control. And that in a lot of cases, it points to, you know, systemic issues, not ones of personal responsibility. Those cases where suddenly you find something in a place that it shouldn't have been, especially when Varonis is involved, it's typically a tooling issue that, you know, you didn't have the tools and, you know, the capabilities to find that kind of thing separate. And I think that's, talk about things that are good for the culture. I think like blameless postmortems are something you can Google and see like how to conduct them and things. And I think they're good for the overall like cybersecurity culture.
I take that just maybe one step further, Mike, and connect it back to what Matt said a little bit earlier is, you know, if they find something that's inappropriate or shouldn't be there, something like that, having a process to deal with it, having that documented process to deal with it is very important. They found it, you know, we'll have to do a postmortem, how did it get there and whatnot, but we have to deal with it. We need a way to deal with it. So bringing it full circle.
I think one thing people often don't realize is that no one's expecting someone to go from 0% secure to 100% secure overnight, right? These external auditors, these regulating boards, what they're really specifically after is continuous improvement, that you have, you know, what risks are out there and that you have a plan to use the resources that you have to address those risks or accept those risks. And sometimes risk acceptance is the only choice that you have, but risk acceptance is better than risk ignorance.
Another security pro that we all respect here, Troy Hunt, also has a really fascinating idea of publicly shaming bad security, because when you have reps of a company make absurd, crazy statements publicly online, it reflects on the company. And I think it only becomes a learning moment when you galvanize the entire internet and security people to explain why certain security principles are significant or incorrect. But I also don't think that it should be done in a mean-spirited way. And Troy has 5 tips to engaging with someone online to never get drawn into technical debates, never allow public debate to escalate, always take potentially volatile discussions off the public timeline, make technical people available, never be dismissive. And I think this is excellent advice, but I think it requires enormous wisdom and maturity in order for a security pro to follow through. Our earlier discussion was a lot about corporate culture. What about the wider world when you get bad service? You can go on Twitter. What are your thoughts about declaring bad security online?
This comes comes in a different sort of way. You know, most of the time, like even so far, we've been talking about, you know, security professionals. And I feel like this is almost something more for like social media managers and people in a marketing role who are often, or even a customer service role, who are often the person that's in control of like the Twitter account at some big company. And I do think it's unreasonable to expect them to be able to make statements around this. And I think there is a name and shaming aspect to this stuff, but a lot of it is, I think, much more than, you know, what they can handle or should they be expected to handle. And so much so that I wonder if they even recognize that they should go into these simple points, that they should go into this like policy of how they should respond, that they think, oh, no, it's fine. Not even recognizing that they've stepped on a landmine in the security community.
We as security practitioners should do our first diligence of trying to contact them directly, right? So the first email or the first time that you're trying to let these people know about this vulnerability, in my opinion, should be private, not in a public domain. Just as a professional courtesy, maybe that's not everyone's MO, but I think that, you know, but if that does goes unresolved, absolutely. Put it in the public domain. You know, you tried.
I think what you're describing, Matt, is, you know, responsible disclosure. That if I find like, oh, this horrible issue that, you know, lets me get into all the customers and credit cards, you know, of some big company. Yes, absolutely. That should be, you know, responsibly disclosed. And again, going to like how important policies are, it is very important to have like a publicly available description of like who to contact, who has some authority around security at an organization, what types of threats they take, to allow that as a pressure valve to accept that. But what's in this article are a lot more things that are gray. Are, do you need HTTPS, you know, on every page of your site? And that's something I think you do. That's something that, you know, the browser makers now think you do, and they've made a lot of UI changes for that. But, you know, a year or two ago, it was less clear that that was the case. Or, you know, the whole part about like, can you paste a password into this password field? Like, it's strong passwords, there's two, it's, you know, separate. It's something that gets into like, hey, can you use password managers for this? Which again is sort of gray. I have an opinion about this. Yes, you should be able to, but it's not, you know, a clear and present danger. There's a lot of nuance in there. And I guess my only concern with all this is I think it's unfair to expect, you know, non-security professionals to even get into this. Like, we're going to talk about something at the end of this with the tools, with a more sophisticated, you know, web security issue. And I would suspect most social media managers cannot, you know, speak to that well, or would recognize even what it was involved with it.
A story related to our topic of public shame is that an engineer was fined for blogging about how to hack into a hotel's Wi-Fi network. And instead of reporting it, he shared it on his blog. And again, we're balancing between the ethics of security and doing the work of security. You know, what if he didn't know you should report it? What if no good deed ever goes unpunished? What if he assumed that someone would find it and then fix it? Because, you know, that sometimes is the purpose of a blog. What are your reactions?
Be in the news for talking about things that are wrong with people's websites and get a lot of media attention and retweets as a result. I think that sometimes it's a self-interest to do a public disclosure first.
I just wanted to point out, he's also not based in America. Is security in another country, is that culture a little different? Because I think that's important to point out as well.
You know, the term that to me that this revolves around is responsibility. And that, you know, if you're reporting this with the goal of protecting people's information, this is not the right way to do it. The responsible disclosure is designed specifically to, you know, help prevent situations like this and to sort of balance the competing interests where, you know, definitely there are security engineers and security practitioners who, you know, look for these type of exploits and write about them, but it needs to be done within the context of responsible disclosure, where there's a chance for the hotel to, you know, in this case, to fix the issues so other people are not put at risk before it's published. That's been done many times successfully. This was, in my mind, the exact wrong thing to do.
And finally, I thought it was surprising that the Mirai botnet authors didn't get any jail time because supposedly, well, they did. They worked really closely with the FBI, and they're all in their early 20s, and I honestly didn't realize or know that they're that young. But at the same time, what they created caused some serious damage, and they're not totally innocent because one author used his knowledge to launch a cyber attack against the school he was attending. What were your reactions?
It's a huge letdown, I think, for making people worry about the penalties and the consequences of their actions, because this was malware that everyone talked about that affected a lot of people. And here you have three people who are not getting charged or sentenced associated with like the real penalties of the Computer Crime and Abuse Act the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And they're not going to jail, right? So what does this say to me if I'm an aspiring hacker? Like, all I have to do is cooperate with the FBI afterwards and I can avoid jail time. And I think that, you know, these sort of white collar crimes that go, you know, quote unquote, unpunished, is not setting a good example, even no matter how closely you work with the FBI. You know, what happened to putting criminals behind bars? I don't know. It may be, maybe I'm lost with the times.
I'm conflicted on this only because, I mean, they does sound like they have significant life-changing consequences to this. 5 years probation, 2,500 hours community service, and $127,000. Those are all, their lives are going to be different post this. I imagine they wish they had never done this, which, you know, that's a good start. I don't know materially how different it would be if they also had 6 months in jail. And I think, you know, we're all, again, as, you know, security culture, trying to come to grips with this and, you know, how these things interact, where it's, and it gets even more complicated, where it wasn't even just that these people were directly attacking other sites, but they were renting out their botnet to other groups for other things. Who knows what came of that? And so it's a mess. And I think we don't know the extent of their cooperation and, you know, bringing down other groups of people and stuff. Like, maybe, yeah, who knows? Yeah, and I think it's hard from the outside to really dig in and say, like, oh, for sure. I for sure would not want 5 years of probation, community service, and $127,000.
Like, on the flip side, right? Like, some people that were downstream impacts of the botnet, like the denial of service, like lost public services, you know, yeah. Water, you know, gas lines, power, electricity. I mean, direct impacts on people's day-to-day lives. And I just think there's we got to strike this balance between, you know, punishing the criminals, no matter how much they help, making examples out of people. And then also, to your point, right? Like, you know, their lives are changed. They do feel remorseful, you know, having a punishment that fits the crime.
Well, I'll kind of weigh in and play devil's advocate on both sides here, because now, you know, Matt, your kind of point, there's something cathartic about it, about seeing the guys pay for kind of the anguish, especially in our field. Is like, it's almost like, you know, maybe it's timely, but yelling at a hurricane, you know, the damage it's done. It's, you know, you feel so upset and angry that it's done this damage and you're powerless to a certain extent to stop it. And we finally got the people that have caused so much anguish. And I think there's something cathartic to want to see them pay. Now, Mike, on the other side, I'll flip this on you. Their life has changed, and I wouldn't necessarily disagree with you. But, you know, these guys also, I think the article also mentioned that one of the guys has like an internship or a job offer from a major security company. So the windfall of this bad behavior is a potentially lucrative job waiting for him as a result of this. There's a lot of maybe outrage there as well, too, for security practitioners on the other side going, we had to clean up this mess, and they're getting rewarded for it. I think there's a lot of emotion involved in it.
Well, that's interesting to bring up emotion, because I kind of feel like, you know, there's a lot of crimes that are emotional, like, you know, someone getting in an argument and, you know, murdering someone, and like, and, you know, there's a thought that in those kind of cases, making sentences that are deterrents don't really help, because, you know, when you're crazed or something, that it's, there's no legalistic thinking. And I feel like in this case, this is a deliberate action. This is, you know, it's not like, oh, wow, I'm mad, I'm going to go, you know, make a botnet out of Internet of Things items and then attack, you know, a variety of infrastructure. I mean, it's, so I think there is a deterrent impact even from this relatively light sentence. Like, certainly a part-time job at a cybersecurity place is probably not outweighing, you know, what these people have been through. Like, I still feel like, yeah, every night they go to sleep wishing they had never done this. And it's hard for me to look at them and imagine someone else going like, man, I wish I could be like these people. I wish I could have done that. It worked out great for them.
I don't know, Mike. I'll play devil's advocate. I have my opinions about this, but I'm just going to play devil's advocate here. You know, and I think there are probably a lot of people out there that will look at them and say, these guys, they did this awesome thing and they got a lot of notoriety. And that's really important. important to some people. And then on the flip side, they also avoided the most extreme consequences. And again, I'm not going to disagree that their lives are not changed. It's hard. I mean, you know, there is an upside. They didn't get jail time, right? They've been rewarded in some senses, and someone could make the argument that, you know, okay, he has this internship, but it might turn to a real job and a lucrative career. How bad could they feel if they're waking up and hopping in their 7 Series, you know what I mean, to drive to their corporate job at some point? I'm playing devil's advocate here, but I think it is encouraging in some ways, and it's not cathartic to other people, you know, to the security professionals, that they're being quote unquote rewarded for it. There's an ethical balance too that we have to take, is like, is the good that they're doing outweighing the harm that they did in some way? And I think Matt alluded to this and you alluded to this. What's that balance? Is their help, again, taking down some of the systems that the FBI was after, or giving the FBI insight into certain operations, is that more valuable in the long term than, you know, the catharsis of seeing these people pay, and I'm using air quotes, for what they did? And that's something hard to, it's hard to wrap your head around sometimes.
We got to go one direction or the other. And if we're going to go to the Wild West direction, where attackers aren't, you know, aren't punished to the fullest extent of the law, sort of like people that caused the financial collapse, you know, I think then that's the direction that we go. But we have cases where, you know, like, you know, soldiers who inadvertently disclose, you know, classified information or doing time at Leavenworth. Then on the other end, people who develop malware that, you know, impacts millions of people get off unscathed, right? I mean, like, no, a lack of incarceration is a significantly different penalty than being incarcerated. And I think that that's a challenge. That's something that the legal system is probably still working out.
You know, software in general has this weird economic thing about, you know, like, you create it once and then you can sell it, you know, an infinite number of times, and there's no individual unit cost for that because, you know, it's just replicated again and again. That has its own, you know, weird implications for lots of different things. But I feel like there's an aspect of that that comes about through the cybersecurity piece too, where you have these, you know, essentially very simple, in a lot of cases, you know, hacks or exploits that could be tremendously damaging to systems. And, you know, like, we're talking a little about Troy Hunt, and like, we worked with Troy to build a web security course. And one of the things we talk about in that is SQL injection. SQL injection is one of those things that, like, you don't need any tools for. You don't need anything except a web browser, and you can type some commands into the URL bar. And it's frightening to think that, like, oh, if you just, you know, type these different commands into, you know, a variety of websites that maybe you have internally or external sites that maybe are not secured well, you could quite likely accidentally exploit and extract out the user's table from one of these sites in a very rapid manner. What's the penalty for that? What should be the penalty for that? And, you know, at the other end of it, you have incredibly sophisticated nation-state attacks against places. And in between, you have these Mirai botnet authors who, you know, use the malware strain and put it together with an exploit. And then, oh my gosh, it took over a whole bunch of stuff. And, you know, they were running at market. There's a lot of different lines in between those two things, none of which are good, none of which I'm condoning, none of which are okay to do, but I don't know if they all mean jail or worse sentencing.
Mike, do we have a tool of the week?
Yes, we do. So in previous podcasts, we have talked about a couple of different websites that were hacked, very public websites that were hacked due to the inclusion of malicious JavaScript files. I think British Airways was one, and the other was maybe Ticketmaster, where, you know, there was a specific JavaScript library that was included on the site that had an obscured URL in it that was used to, you know, transition credit card information as it was entered off of the website. And it's a challenge. You're running a website. How do you describe on that from the web server the behaviors that should take place in the interaction between the web browser, the network, and the server? And what you'd love to be able to do is say, hey, only run JavaScript from this one domain we trust. Only load images from this one domain we trust. Only take these precautions and, you know, let things run in this particular way. And how you do that is with something called content security policies. So these are headers that are put in the server, or they can be put in as meta tags on the actual page. And then the browser, when it interprets them, takes those restrictions into account. And so the tool of this week is CSP parse. So this is a content security policy parser, and it uses Google's API to retrieve the headers and also looks at these meta tags and gives them back in a nice structured way. And So there's two things that hopefully will be in the show notes. One is the link to this tool, and the other is then a more comprehensive description from Mozilla's website about exactly how to use content security policy headers to try to prevent these sort of things, where you can go in and say, hey, only run scripts from, you know, the one domain we have whitelisted that would let this happen. So this is something I'm really excited about because I think it has the potential to, you know, systematically increase the security across huge chunks of the internet and stop all sorts of different attacks. So that's it. CSP Parse for content security policies.
Thank you to Mike Buckby, Killian Engler, Matt Radilak, and all our listeners for joining us today. If you enjoyed our panel discussion, please subscribe to our show. You can find more episodes of the Inside Out Security Show on Apple Podcasts, Overcast, SoundCloud, and more. And if you have a minute, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and tell other people about the show. It helps them discover great discussions like we had today. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks, everyone. Have a great one.